Get up in it.
This feels official in a way that I should no longer be a part of this. I feel like this has now reached a level of class and distinction that like I do not belong in.
Oh, we're using headphones? I'm sorry.
Is that I actually have to see myself?
I think it was like Mark Twain who said I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would accept me. That's how I feel. Do I listen to a podcast that would actually talk to me? Oh.
Welcome to TikTok Theology, a podcast that tackles the major trending topics on social media that concern the Christian faith. I'm Megan.
And I'm Steven. We know you can't form a theology in 3 minutes or less, but those videos can identify current issues. TikTok will give us the prompt, and then we'll do a deep dive. Thanks for joining us in this exploration.
Hi, friends. Can you believe we're already coming to the end of season 4?
Right at the end.
Oh, time flies
mm-hmm.
when you're having fun.
Yep.
Come on, somebody. Anyways, team, today we're going to be having a really, really fantastic conversation. It's not just going to be me and Steven yapping as usual. We have a lovely guest that we will get to present in a second. But today we're going to be talking about profiling Jesus. Now, that seems like one of those things that people are going to get upset about immediately. So hold on, don't get upset yet. Let us explain. I think that it's a really important conversation, especially something that we've seen and had other conversations in this season about Christianity not being a westernized religion and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of speaks into the issue and the wrestling with like a white Jesus that we have seen presented in a lot of ways. I remember, I think I had like a kid's Bible, like one of those picture kids Bibles. And I think he was white in that picture Bible that I had as a kid.
At least like light beige.
Yeah, like definitely, but definitely not like brown.
Okay.
So I think there's definitely this like conversation and issue of like how we represent Jesus.
Yeah.
And that I think it leads to the fact that we don't really understand all that well who Jesus was. We understand how he relates to us, you know, biblically and stuff like that. But I think it's also important to understand where Jesus comes from and like what that means for, you know, how we understand him and how we understand scripture. And so I think we're going to get to dig into that today.
Yeah. It's an issue that's, in social media, especially as we were like politicized and you have like politicized, even marketed versions of Jesus like,
oh, yeah.
on merch and different things. and he's got a look and a vibe and he's everyone's Jesus. Like he's this for me and this for me and this for me.
Like Talladega Nights.
Yeah.
Like he's like my Jesus. 6-pound, 8-ounce or 8-pound, 6-ounce baby Jesus. I pray to my Jesus in a tuxedo shirt.
Exactly like Talladega Nights. But yeah, so I mean, the issue here is Jesus is historical.
Right.
And as we come from a faith tradition, he's living.
Right.
This. So when we talk about profiling Jesus, we want to get into who Jesus is.
And that he was a real person.
That he was a real person. He is a real person. He's alive now in us. And I think there's an important point about how we can contextualize Jesus in a way that's like helpful and fruitful. We can know him in our own context.
Right.
But then we still have to remember the history of who Jesus is. And we have a very, I'm excited about our guest. And so I'm looking at him right now. We were like, you know what? When we go through this, I think the best person to talk about this is the tallest theologian we can find.
Yeah. We just looked around and we were like, all right, who's up there?
Chris. All right.
I love that so much.
All right. Tallest theologian we can find. I'm sure there's others out there.
I was going to say, there's definitely more out there who are going to beat me. I mean,
I think I'm going to get you a shirt for Christmas.
I'll take
tallest theologian we could find.
that's some TikTok theology merch right there.
There you go. The tallest theologian we could find.
That would get me around. Most introductions I have usually lead with, my word, you're tall. As if it's something I should be surprised to find
out. Well, really?
Like, what?
I didn't know that when I bought pants last time.
All right. Well, let me go ahead and tell you about our friend, Chris White. Now, he is actually our colleague and he works at LPU, but he is recently graduated with a PhD from the University of St. Andrews. Just came back to the States.
Yeah. Only been back for a couple months.
Yeah. Only been back for a couple months. And so he's like still working on his American accent right now. You
know? Aren't we all? All of us European educated folks in this room.
Actually, all of us are.
I know. That's why I've been trying to shake that British accent for years.
Oh, there you go.
That's a lie. I'm sorry, everyone.
I still get looks when I ask where the nappies are. And they, you know, just you're in a store and they look at you like you're a fool.
You're like,
right. Nappies. Sorry. Diapers. Do you have diapers?
Okay. Like, that's my fault.
I apologize.
Yeah. But one thing about Chris that I think is really interesting, it's not really going to play a lot into what we're talking about here. but you are a Bonhoeffer scholar. And that is pretty amazing because Bonhoeffer is like the dude.
And that's also been a social media conversation recently with all of
that. Yeah, that recent, there was the family getting angry at Eric Metaxas for about that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of overlaps with this conversation, actually.
Yeah.
Because Bonhoeffer, in a lot of ways, has the Talladega Nights phenomenon. Because, you know, it's interesting.
He's all Bonhoeffers to all people.
He is. It's wild how many people will say, you know, my Bonhoeffer would have never. And you're like, oh, that's really interesting.
He was an actual dude,
because
though.
He's just Bonhoeffer.
You would think, but I mean, no. I feel like most areas of study or interest or fandom, you know, have a tendency to recast the object of their affection in a certain image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and you know, then we're always surprised to find out when that person is much more human than we want them to be. I'm not speaking of Jesus, just to be clear. Before
right.
people come
yes.
with
before
me. Come
before we get blasphemed. Before we get smelt in this room.
I do think we just have that tendency to project quite a bit. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Great. So before we get into that conversation, I think we should talk about the historicity of Jesus. So I'm going to throw some facts, some quotes out for us here to kind of frame our discussion before we get into how he's construed in culture. So Jesus is a historical figure. Now, some people might contest that claim, but it's not really contested by historians. And this is what I think is very important for people to see. For example, if Siddhartha Gautama was a historical figure, that's contested. Because the only anything that we have about it, writing about it, are Buddhist texts.
Right.
So there's nothing outside of Buddhist texts that tell us if the Buddha was an actual historical person.
Right.
Whereas Jesus, there are lots of things outside of Christian texts
right.
that affirm Jesus's personhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so really for Christianity, it's less a question if he was a real person, because that seems to be historical fact in the way that anything can be a historical fact.
Right.
Obviously we weren't there.
What?
I mean, any way that it can be a historical fact, it is. So the question is not if he's a historical figure. It is if you believe he is Lord.
Right.
And that's the question that determines a Christian. So some facts here. One, Jesus was born during the reign of Caesar Augustus. Augustus reigned from 27 to BCE to 14 CE in Judea, which was occupied by Rome. Now, BCE and CE, you might see people might question what that is. it essentially aligns up with before Christ and Anno Domini, not after death. It's actually Anno Domini, the day of our Lord. And the reason why historians and other traditions will use BCE and CE is because it is a non-religious way of talking about that determined period of time. And if you think about it, we would probably feel pretty uncomfortable if we were like in the day of Muhammad.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
You know what I mean? And so it's just a way to kind of like just be neutral.
Neutrality is not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. If you're in a generally Christian context and you're using BC and AD, like nobody's going to bat an eye on that. But if you're like in an academic context, they might. So so that's just the point there.
You're a little tidbit heads up for
right for episode. People. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Jesus was killed during the reign of Tiberius, and that was from 14 to 37. And Pontius Pilate was the governor of the province of Judea. And there was governors. They were obviously occupied by Rome in general. But what Rome would do is they would let all these like places have their own governments. And they would just basically, you'd have to pay allegiance and pay taxes to them. And they would offer protection or whatever. And so they had like these dual governments they were paying taxes to. Mm-hmm. Paying taxes to Israel, but also to Rome. Herod the Great ruled the Jews from 37 to 4 CE, 37 BCE to 4 CE. And then the Jewish kingdom was split between his sons. And Herod Antipas ruled Galilee and Perea from 4 CE to 39 CE. So he was the Herod during the time of Jesus. Now, there's several non-Christian texts that corroborate Jesus' life and existence. So one of the most famous is Cornelius Tacitus. Now, he's a Roman historian hired by Rome. And his job was to basically talk about all of the period from Caesar Augustus's death to the death of Nero. And he did that in the Annals. And then there's the Histories, and that's from Nero's death to the reign of Domitian, which was 96. And so he wrote both of these, and these were authoritative texts for all Roman history.
Mm-hmm.
In the Annals, he actually has a section where he talks about Jesus. And he says this, Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius. But the pernicious superstition, repressed for a time, broke out again, not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. So this affirms Jesus, Christus, and the founder, and it affirms that he was put to death by Pontius Pilate, mm-hmm. and that Christianity existed this way. And it does so in a negative light. It's actually saying it...
Mischief
is saying it's bad. Okay, and so then there was another one, Pliny the Younger. He was a Roman governor in Bithynia mm-hmm. in 112, and he wrote to Emperor Trajan, and he was actually seeking advice of how to treat Christians because he kept killing them because they wouldn't recant. And so he was like...
Said, hey guys, not sure what to do about this. Please comment how to
so many of them are dying. He asked the emperor, he can't get them to curse Christ, which a genuine Christian cannot be induced to do. And so this affirms both the existence of Christ and the Christians that were being martyred. And then one of the most famous that people talk about is Flavius Josephus. So he was a Jewish priest, general, and a historian. And he was hired by Rome mm-hmm. to write a Jewish history for them. And so he wrote the Jewish Antiquities in 94 CE. Here there's a passage about Jesus. Now, some people are wondering if it was, there's two versions of it. Mm-hmm. An older version has some less Christian sounding language. And then the other version has more Christianized sounding language in it. But even the lesser one affirms Jesus as a historical figure. Mm-hmm. But it says this. It says, now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as to receive the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets, and foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. That last bit was the thing that people believe was added. But before that, he was already affirmed as a historical figure, mm-hmm. A miracle worker and stuff, a doer of miracle in the oldest version. Mm-hmm. And so right there, you have what any historian would need to corroborate the existence of a historical figure. Mm-hmm. Non-Christian accounts of a Christian figure, boom, donezo. That's not the question. The question is not, does Jesus exist? Did Jesus exist and was Jesus a historical figure? That is a historical fact as any historical fact can be secure, mm-hmm. you know, in the same way that Julius Caesar was historical figure.
Right.
So now the question is Jesus Lord? And this is basically what makes a Christian. And we're not going to get into it and have like the tons of apologetic arguments. I think one that's pretty powerful is some people are like, well, did they, you know, remove the body, the disciples, and it was a great, great scheme. Well, all the disciples died horrific deaths, yeah. except for John. But he was, according to Christian tradition, boiled alive. He just didn't die.
Yeah.
And so
he was tortured.
He just didn't die. And so with that being said, the witness of the disciples and all the people who were actually martyred and died, that doesn't make sense logically for all of them to go through that, never recant Jesus, if it was all a farce.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like an apologetic that we would use to kind of show the validity of it. So first, I would say, Chris, do you have any... like insights or thoughts about this? What do you think about that before we get into the contextualizations?
I mean, thoughts is broad. I think what you're highlighting is important because whenever we have a conversation like this, you kind of have to put your cards on the table for why you're having it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because when we talk about who Jesus was, there have been scholarly moves by atheists to say Christ is a myth. Didn't exist in history. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to use the historical record when you make that move to try and, you know, find evidence that supports this idea that you just had this splinter cult that came up with this idea and came up with this name and these stories and they corroborated and were, you know, so deluded that they're willing to be martyred. And so in that sense, when you're coming at that angle, you have to do a lot of work, right? And we talk about this. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of what you were saying, there's a professor of New Testament at Cambridge named Simon Gathercole. And I love this quote. He says, I'm paraphrasing now, but he says, you know, basically it doesn't matter. The question is not whether Jesus lived and then died. That's pretty settled. The mm-hmm. question is whether he died and then lived.
And that's good. And
I just, the way that's framed. I like that way of framing it just because I think when we look at the examination of history as a way to determine whether he lived, you have to do a lot of work to pretend that the historical record mm-hmm. doesn't corroborate that.
Right.
And you have to change your standard for how we determine if a historical figure lived.
Right.
Because we don't raise the same standard for other historical figures. So mm-hmm. I think it's okay to be honest about that. mm-hmm. and say, we don't have to so much question, did he, as much as we can examine what, where, how, mm-hmm. what did this mean?
Right.
So it's a different set of questions. And I think the apologetic is helpful because it just kind of, it sets the table for the conversation we want to have. It kind mm-hmm. of goes, look, mm-hmm. are we all there? Are we on the same page? You know, if someone says, I still don't believe it, then you have to have a much longer conversation
right.
about historical texts.
Yeah.
But that's not really where we're going.
No, it's not.
So now that we can all kind of establish that, we, at least the three of us in this room and most historian friends would agree yeah. without a doubt that Jesus did live. That is, you're right, Chris, not necessarily the conversation that we're having today. So in the nature of what we're actually trying to ask and get to the deeper, you know, conversation of behind this is, how have we characterized Jesus throughout the centuries?
So I love the way you asked that. Because how have we characterized Jesus points to the fact that we have characterized
we
Jesus.
We have done so.
and I think that's important to own.
Mm-hmm.
You said that earlier about, you know, the image of Jesus in the, you know, a Sunday school Bible.
Yeah.
A year ago, we were looking for books for our kids that would have, you know, would lay out the Easter story and the Nativity story. Maybe mm-hmm. it was 2 years ago. You know, mm-hmm. my daughter's four. My son's seven, you know, something accessible for both my daughter and my son.
Yeah.
And it was wild trying to find a Bible that didn't have a white Jesus in it.
Yeah.
Like still,
yeah.
this isn't a new thing.
Yeah.
And I always think it's interesting because I'm not necessarily pointing to the church when I say this, but there's a phenomenon lately where people get very aggravated if a mythical figure is misrepresented. And so famously there was a huge debate over whether Santa was white.
Like, oh yeah, I actually did see that.
This was animated. I mean, now if you're talking about, you know, Nicholas the Saint,
yeah.
right.
Slap a heretic.
You know, that's another fun conversation, but, but we can talk about where he lived, but are we talking about that Santa, or are we still talking about the one who delivers presents? Because yeah. that's imaginary. And yet it was this heated conversation, right? But Christians broadly have a lot of, you know, for most of the last, I don't want to overstate this. It's pretty common not to think about it, mm-hmm. just to say, oh, that's mm-hmm. great. That's Jesus. And it would be an interesting assignment to have everyone draw what they think Jesus looked like, because I have a similar upbringing and my Jesus looked pretty similar to like a Southern California surfer,
yeah.
you know, kind mm-hmm. of a, you know, wizened surf coach who I might run into at, you know, in like Orange
he
County.
He sits barefoot on his surfboard on the sandy surf.
So I have a fun little story here that has to do with this sort of.
this sort of.
So I was a high school art teacher before I became a professor while I was working on my PhD and stuff. And one of my assignments, I was teaching them how to do portraits and made them. It was like, hey, you can, and they're young, they're like 9th, 10th graders. And it's like my drawing one class. And they were like, okay, so you guys have to get a picture printed out in black and white, and then you can draw whoever you want. You know, like it's totally up to you. I will supply an image if you don't bring one, but make sure you do. And so as a punishment, I gave them an image of me, which is hilarious. So I had like 20 students.
Funny.
It's like 40 students, and like half of them are drawing me, right?
Well, yeah.
So
for 9th, 10th grade, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was great. Now it's their fault. They could have drawn whoever they wanted to, but now they're drawing me. And what was hilarious, we did critiques afterwards. Everyone created me in their own image.
Wow.
They mixed my features with their own features.
That's wow. so funny.
And so there was a version of me that looked like Drake because it was drawn by an African-American student. There was a version of it that looked Mexican because it was drawn by a Mexican student. There was I remember this one, like this little little white boy. He was a little country boy. And he made me look straight up like, what's that painting? You know, the old man and the old woman with the farmer.
Oh, American Gothic.
American Gothic. He made me look just like the dude from American
Gothic.
With the pitchfork? Yeah, with the pitchfork. Yeah. And so it was just so funny. And I told them, I was like, because one of the main keys of drawing is like, draw what you see and not what you know. Your mind has already made determinations of things. The features that you've seen the most are your own. You've looked in the mirror more than you've seen anybody else. And mm-hmm. so, and your family and people that are close to you. And so whenever you like start drawing eyes, you just reflex and start drawing what you know and not what you're actually seeing of how this person is. And so that's a big thing in art is to separate that. But I think that's what we do with Jesus. is we essentially, we don't read what we see, we read what we know.
We've also sort of been, we've been trained to a certain imagination. I mean, this is one of the things, like J. Cameron Carter talks about this, that, you know, when Immanuel Kant was, you know, outlining, you know, his theological vision for humanity, that he described Jesus as the, you know, the personification of the good principle, that he's the ideal human. But at the same time was articulating that some humans are more ideal than others, and that it happened that, you know, Euro-Anglo humans were transcending race and all other peoples were trapped in, you know, this excess, this particularity of race that they were trapped in. And so there is this philosophical tradition that not only does, you know, plays on how we project, but also tries to train us that Jesus looks a certain way. And it's mapped onto this particular anthropological vision of what it means to be a good human. And so it's both, right? So it's, we can do that, but why is it? I was traveling once and I was visiting a friend in Thailand, and I was speaking with someone who said I looked like Jesus. And I thought about that, you know, like how far reaching this kind of enterprise is to depict Jesus as a white man, right? And so we have to own that, because there is a racialized history to it, just even as race becomes articulated as an idea that was being articulated by, you know, broadly Christian, whether you think they were Christian or not, that's a whole different debate, you know, philosophers and theologians who are saying, you know, if he's ideal, if he's good, what is ideal and good? And it's mapped onto this imagination that to be European,
it's interesting.
You know, so there's ways where it's not just that. It's not just we project, but we're trained to project in a certain way. And I think Christians can say a lot about whether we think it's a good idea to have someone else tell us what Jesus should look like.
Right.
Now, to be fair, you do look a little bit like the actor from
like Jim Caviezel.
The Chosen.
No.
Yes, you do.
No, I
do got
not.
A little bit of that vibe.
Not even a little.
Because he's not white. They did a good job casting.
I've been told I look like the center forward for the German national soccer team. I think that's. I feel like that's two one. Very
really?
Different. I feel like this Thomas Mueller. That's.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
now?
Yeah, I absolutely know what you're talking about.
So I would say I can see that one more than. I'm fairly Germanic.
Perhaps.
But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Albrecht Dürer's version of Jesus. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. I think if you guys cut your hair the same, I think you definitely would have a resemblance here to Thomas Mueller.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny, though, because I was thinking about that. I was teaching a class on Christology, and I was I just looked for images of Jesus. And one of the first ones that popped up is this stained glass window in Dordrecht in the Netherlands. And it's not that Jesus is white, but he's blonde. Like he's really blonde. Yeah. He looks more like Patrick Swayze in Point Break than he does.
Like
anyone
looks
who
like
I would imagine
Gordon's fisherman
living in Judea under Roman rule. Yeah. You know, in the first century, and it's just interesting that and it was posted. Oh, this is a beautiful. You know, nobody. It's interesting how little you hear people say, "Huh, he's really blonde." You know, it's just
look
interesting
that
we've been formed in a way to not even kind of recoil and think, "Well, that doesn't look quite right." And And I say that because a lot of times when we look at art and representation, and when people think about different historical figures or mythical figures, or they depict art in a contextual lens, there is a different response. And in that same lecture, I showed a painting by a Chinese artist who depicted Jesus' baptism, but in a traditional Chinese style. And the response was much more, well, that looks off. And so it's interesting. Yeah. You know, why is it that Euro-Anglo Jesus doesn't cause a reaction, but Chinese Jesus does? And that speaks to how we've been kind of trained to have a certain imaginary around what Jesus looks like.
Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, I didn't even think, I think I thought genuinely Jesus was white until I went to college. Not because anybody told me that. It was just the only way he was ever depicted in places that I was.
Right.
Like in pictures or in, like, not because anyone said to me, Jesus is a white man. But because that's the only thing I ever saw until I took my ancient civilizations class. And someone was like, hey guys, just remember that where Israel is and like what that is. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Or at least, especially in the context that I was in, like told me in a lot of ways that Jesus was white. And I just kind of was like, okay.
So for me, I didn't ever think about it as Jesus is white, but I saw him as a reflection of myself. And which is a little different. Like I didn't see him with like your complexion, Megan. Like, I never saw that. But I did see him as, like, looking like a half Puerto Rican, half German. You know what I'm saying? Like, just, like, literally, like, myself.
Yeah.
And I think there's that reflex that we have, too, just from this is who you know, this is what you know. Mm-hmm. And the training, I think, is crucial, because that's like when you have other cultures that this is not what they know and they still affirm a white Jesus or something like that, then you're like, okay, we've gone beyond just kind of this natural reflex.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because if you think about it, you would expect, you know, if you went into a, you know, a culture with no sort of artistic aesthetic formation on what Jesus would look like, right, it wouldn't be surprising for that culture to say, for their imagination of what an ancient person looked like, you know, and you see this across art, you see this across, you know, literature.
Yeah, totally.
And that's a really great point. Like, projection is perhaps not surprising. When you talked about your art project, that's what we would kind of expect with imagination. It is surprising when, you know, communities and cultures have been given an imagination that's foreign. And, you know, kind of it's imposed in a sense.
It seems that projection and contextualization in a lot of ways is human. Like, we just kind of do that because that's what we do. But, I mean, I think the important conversation here is to ask, and I think, Chris, you should speak to this, is why is it crucial to recognize Jesus as Jewish, as a man from the Levant area of, like, in, like, ancient Near East? Like, why is that understanding of who Jesus was important for us as believers and as Christians to, we can project and we can contextualize and stuff in a lot of ways that is the spiritual relational aspect of loving Jesus. But why is it important for us to remember and to integrate who Jesus really was as a person and where he was from?
Okay. So that's another amazing question. So we have kind of wholesale inherited, you know, when I say we, I'm referring to Christians in the West, Christians in, you know, the United States, sort of the Greco-Roman metaphysical imagination of what it means to worship Jesus, right? First 400 years of the church, most of the arguments were, how can one person be God and human? And it's these metaphysical debates. Does he have a human mind or a God mind? You know, does he have, does he just look human or is he human? Like, these were the debates. And within that, it has a tendency to change what it means to worship Jesus into, do I have the right metaphysical idea? And I think the shame of that, and I think this is why it's important, is that the incarnation happens in time. It happens in a moment of in history, and it's a part of the larger sweep of redemptive history that runs from creation all the way to the kingdom come. And in this moment in time, Jesus is actively speaking into what is happening and what will happen. And so if we don't understand what it meant for Jesus to live when he lived, to, you know, join the history he joined, and to anticipate the future he is anticipating and when he joined it, you know, if we don't do that, we're essentially, we don't mean to say this, I don't think anyone means this intentionally, but we are, in our apathy, saying that we don't really care what was important to Jesus.
So we let him know.
Scott McKnight has a book called The King Jesus Gospel, where he really, his question is really simple. He's like, you know, if you ask any Christian what the gospel is, they'll usually lean on, for it's been by grace you've been saved through faith and not by works, so that no one can boast. Amazing. But Jesus never said that. And doesn't even say anything close when he's proclaiming the good news. So how do we make sense of, because of course that's the gospel, but what was the gospel for Jesus, right? You know, it's the coming of the kingdom. It's it's the restoration of Israel. It's God's compassion for humanity. These are things that he's saying that are very meaningful in his time and place. I think when we take his time and his place, how he understood himself, you know, as a rabbi, you know, as someone who lived, you know, in the line of David, as someone who is recapitulating history, as someone who's remembering everything that Israel has done, in, you know, and describing, when you mentioned the law and the prophets, right? You think about the road to Emmaus. When the two, you know, disciples are confused, he doesn't go, hey, don't worry, let me describe what the church is going to be like, right? He recounts all of Israel's history and describes how it all points to himself. It's so important to Jesus. And so the question is what is important to Jesus important to us? Because when we ask the question, when we're asking the question of lordship, I think it's easy to forget that these conversations are part of our worship. And so do we want to worship Jesus on his terms or ours?
That's great.
So I think that, to me, is the thing that we have to be coming with. So it's not that we're just history buffs who really want to get it right, but we want to resist the tendencies to obscure what was important to Jesus, to obscure the people who were important to Jesus, mm-hmm. the timing.
Yeah.
We also want to find out why he was communicating what he was communicating and what he was intending. Mm-hmm. You know, the woman at the well is a great example of this. If we don't understand Jewish Samaritan tension, that whole interaction
doesn't make sense.
It's just an interesting sort of, wow, this, you know, cool. Jesus knows a lot about this woman and tells her, you know, and it just oversimplifies something that's much more dramatic. Anyway, so I could go on for a long time on that.
Awesome. That's powerful.
That's fantastic.
That's powerful. That'll preach too. That'll preach.
That will preach, tell you what. You know what I'm saying? But I also think it's like, to that effect, is like when, if you're removing the fact that like the importance of the timing in which Jesus lived, it almost is like, oh, well, you know, we could have just dropped Jesus any old place in history, like, and kind of takes out the intentionality and like so much of like prophetic fulfillment of like him being there and like how that was an intentional decision. And like that was the perfect spot in which he was meant to exist in history. And so to kind of isolate all of that, I feel like does in a lot of ways diminish the impact that Jesus had on the space and time that he was in. And then how much it like really would diminish a little bit, like what was said in scripture and all the things that pointed to him as a savior, because it would be like, oh, well then if we theoretically could have just dropped Jesus any old place and any old time, then you're not understanding like the depth of, you know, Jesus's mm-hmm. life and what that means for us and what that meant for like fulfillment of the Old Testament.
I just love the idea. Make important for you what was important for Jesus. Whew, come on. And this leads, I think, to our last question. We like to end with kind of like a practical application, because we both have this conviction that like when you do theology that is like not, doesn't affect the church, then it's like kind of besides the point. And me and you, we've hung out a lot in the in academic circles, and we've probably seen a lot of this. It's just like, okay, you're just thinking to think, which is cool in its own realm. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, we want to help people be drawn deeper to who Jesus is, to be drawn deeper into their discipleship. So we always want to end with that kind of very practical level response. And that being the case, how do you think these ideas that we're talking about here can affect the church? And this could be locally, but also globally.
I have to say this really carefully. I think most of these conversations are they're scalpel conversations, not sledgehammer conversations. Mm-hmm. You talk about separating, you know, bone from marrow. Like mm-hmm. you really have to be careful. And to answer, I'm going to kind of work backward from horror, if that's okay.
Yeah, okay.
You know, during the Third Reich, the Nazis had a de-Judaization Institute, which was designed to find and strip all elements of Jewish identity from Christian practice and religion. Mm. Like that was an institute that was founded.
It's crazy.
To seriously obscure parts of history. Mm. And, you know, we hear things like this, or we think about slavers during chattel slavery mm-hmm. who used Philippians 2 and the idea that Jesus took on the form of a slave as justification for slavery.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we see these horrors when people weaponize or obscure or corrupt who Jesus really was to nefarious purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We never think we're part of that, right? We hear these things and we think, you know, well, you know, sort of pharisaically, thank God I'm not like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if we take Jesus seriously, coming back to how he thinks about things, you know, he has a tendency to take the standard back to the very, very, the smallest sparks of evil, right? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you say you don't murder, but are you angry at your brother?
Right. Yeah.
Do you curse him in your heart? Right. Mm-hmm. These questions. And so, if we work backwards from that type of horror, I think what matters is, where am I overlooking or obscuring or weaponizing for my purposes, you know, for what's important to me, who Jesus is that should confront me? Because if he's Messiah, if he's Lord, and Messiah, I mean, we didn't have time for this, but Jesus's understanding of Messiah as a rabbi has a whole host of consequences for anyone who seriously wants to follow him.
Yeah.
Right.
That if we understand how that term was used throughout the Old Testament, it changes how we follow, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that feeling of, is it important to Jesus, comes down to, where are the seeds of a similar impulse, you know, you know, yeah, we all like to say, you know, like, I'm not a Nazi, I wouldn't do that. But are we stripping things from his self-declared identity, mm-hmm. who, how he described himself, how he did his, you know, his ministry, mm-hmm. consciously or unconsciously, in ways that has impacts for other people, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so when we come back to the projection thing, I think it's beautiful that slaves in chains were able to know that Jesus was acquainted with suffering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, James Cone's The Cross and the Lynching Tree points out that missing the fact that his crucifixion, you know, was an execution at the hands of Rome,
yeah.
causes you to miss that he understood what it was to be lynched on a tree.
Right.
And that miss enabled Christians for hundreds of years to just accept or sanction slavery.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so the geopolitical history, you know, you asked about the region, mm-hmm. the geopolitical history of Jesus's region. You think about Assyrian conquest and how it named it Palestina. And then, yeah. you know, the Romans then named it Judea. And then the Romans put down the Bar Kokhba revolt. I hope I said that right, but they put down a revolt and then renamed the region, you know, renamed the region Palestine as part of that, that there's this complex history with names, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so if say a Palestinian Christian remembers the history of the name Palestine and says, oh, Jesus is from the region I'm from, that's beautiful. But that can also be weaponized. We've seen anti-Semitic sentiment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I say this to say, Jesus's identity, when best, should bring us into faithfulness to him in worship, mm-hmm. an ethic that aligns with his ethic, mm-hmm. which includes compassion for the poor and the downtrodden and the oppressed, and 100%. You know, that declares the year of the Lord's favor and understands how the year of the Lord's favor affected those who are suffering or in bondage, those in chains, like these things.
Yeah.
And our apathy to what matters to Jesus often points back to that same thing. And so I think when you talk about the practical, I think it's easy to forget that the name Christian came about because early Christians were acting so much like Jesus. They were serving and they were acting and they were living out his ethic. They weren't just worshiping him as God. They were doing Jesus things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so where have I allowed myself to ignore, miss, or project over, impose my own narrative over Jesus' story in a way that gives me permission to not act like him?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think, yeah, that's maybe that's not the same thing as the, you know, the Nazi effort, but is it a spark of evil that Jesus asked me to overcome in worship of him as I allow his self-revelation, how he revealed himself in time and place to challenge that?
That's good.
And I probably said something in there that could offend people. I just mean it genuinely. Like, what brings us into the most faithful discipleship to Jesus that worships him the most and says again and again, renew my mind to be like yours.
That's good.
That's the heart of it.
I have recently just released a book, The Problem and Providence of Freedom. But in it, I talk about how Jesus, when he talks about all those jubilee, mm-hmm. I've come to declare the day of the Lord. Pentecost, I argue, could be seen as a cosmic jubilee. Mm-hmm. So what was made for the Jews to bring justice to the whole world, mm-hmm. The Spirit being poured out on all flesh, now becomes that thing that this is the message that can spread out to the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about that thought and the way you just kind of framed it is like, that's what was important to Jesus. Jesus claimed that as his own ministry. And so what the church should do, and we're the ones who are spirit empowered, we should go out and proclaim Christ's ministry for the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we do that, yeah, we're going to see ourselves being confronted. We're going to see our own hearts being confronted. But fundamentally, we're going to see powers and principalities and all sorts of things being confronted, because all things that are not of Christ are going to be confronted in us and outside of us and everywhere. And being open and ready for that, I think is one, it's a prophetic task. It's a beautiful task, that the church can do, but also, and I think what you're really hitting that's crucial is let's actually look at ourselves in this and see how we've been implicated by some of the same things that we might ask somebody else to check on themselves. We're out of time, but I feel like I've already had a couple of coffees with you, and we've already talked for like long time, spilling over and getting late to class and stuff like that. But because it's so good, you're such a thoughtful, well-spoken fellow, and I think your heart for God and God's people shines through so clearly. And I think this is such an important thing, something that can be weaponized. We should look at it as not the thing that weaponizes that, but the thing that actually unifies us as we all be conformed to the image of Christ and who Christ actually is as we profile him. Mm-hmm. Not who we think he is, but who he actually is.
It's good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris, for being on today.
Yeah,
we're so thankful for you speaking to us, preaching to us, preaching to the people. And friends, as always, these episodes are sponsored by LPU School of Theology and Ministry.
All right. We'll see you next time.
See ya.